Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Hey, True Crime Cast fans, really excited today to have a bonus episode for you. We are going to talk to Anya and Kevin from the Murder Sheet podcast, specifically about their new book, Shadow of the Bridge, The Delphi Murders and the Dark Side of the American Heartland. We go into depth about what it was like covering the trial, what things were like in Delphi then, what things are like now. So really fascinating. I think you're going to enjoy this interview. I'm thrilled to be joined today by Anya Kane and Kevin Greenlee of the Murder Sheet podcast. Known a lot about you guys for a long time. We missed each other at CrimeCon. I don't know about your listeners, but we talk about CrimeCon every episode since we got back. And did you all have a good time?
We had a wonderful time. And thank you so much for asking, Jamie. I am so sorry we missed you guys at CrimeCon as well. But yeah, we had a blast.
It was our first CrimeCon. It was kind of overwhelming, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, people were so nice. Like, I couldn't get over just so many positive interactions. And we were super nervous, but I felt like people were just so nice and so kind. And I will never not be an evangelist for CrimeCon now that I've been to it once. So I'm that person now.
No, I completely agree. I'm on board with you. And I'm glad you guys were busy. You were there with your new book, Shadow of the Bridge, The Delphi Murders and the Dark Side of the American Heartland. We talked some before we started recording, but you guys have been very into this case. You weren't doing this when it started, but you went to a lot of the trial. Why did you attach yourselves to this case and really dive so far in to that one?
I think we saw an opportunity when we moved back to Indiana. So we met during the pandemic and we're living in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, okay. Kevin,
yeah. So we're a pandemic romance and a pandemic podcast. So moved back to Indiana where Kevin's from. And we saw how much for Hoosiers and really truly for people around the world, but especially for people in Indiana, this case resonates so much. It's two innocent, beautiful girls who go out doing something totally innocuous that kids should be allowed to do, go on a walk on a, you know, nice public trail, and they never came back. And people were outraged and people were angry and people were confused. Why is this case not solved yet? One of the girls, Liberty German, captured the guy approaching them on her phone. So how do we not know what happened? So that
and it was also it was also a time in the case where not much was happening, because an arrest in this case was not made until 2022. And before that, there were long stretches of time where there just wasn't that much news and the police weren't really talking, but people had a lot of questions. And of course, reporters don't report on things unless there's things happening.
Of course.
But we have the luxury that we could really just kind of pause and devote a lot of time to it. And even though there wasn't a lot happening that was news, we could start talking to people, develop sources, get to know the town. And I think that really helped us.
Yeah.
Right. And talk about getting to know the town. You live in Indiana, but not necessarily in Delphi. So what was that process like of introducing yourselves? I also imagine there's a lot of trust building that happens.
That's a really apt point. Yes. As you can imagine, this crime, these two kids getting murdered and it going unsolved for years, was incredibly traumatic for the community, certainly for the families and those who knew the girls, but for the wider community too. Parents are thinking, can I let my kid like go out for the day, or is something going to happen to them next? And it was more than that. Unfortunately, this case has attracted a lot of toxic behavior online. I want to qualify that, because most of the people who are interested in this case online are absolutely fine. They just want to know about the case and have facts and are interested. And there's nothing wrong with that. There is a very small but very vocal and active minority of people who are essentially like conspiracy theorists and who like broke their brains over this case.
Yeah.
And like, they will harass people. They will just randomly accuse people of possibly being the killer. And the Delphi community has had to deal with that for years. So it's not only there's a killer on the loose, there's also if some weirdo on social media finds my picture and thinks, oh, my husband in the background looks like Bridge Guy, they're going to post that. And suddenly it's going to be my problem. And I think that really made it something where we didn't just walk in there and everyone started talking to us. We had to show that we were legitimate and that we were going to try to do this in an ethical and responsible way. And I'm a journalist. Kevin's an attorney. Right. But I also, you know, I wasn't on the crime beat before I started this. I was on the retail beat. Kevin was an intellectual property attorney. We don't pretend to have experience. We don't. But we do try to employ the ethics and the kind of learnings of those fields to what we're doing. But it was a slow process. At first, people were just not wanting to talk. And I think eventually they said, OK, these people have good intentions. So perhaps I can trust them with some more information.
Absolutely. That trust is so important. And you said you guys weren't necessarily trained for this, but this, I think the skills are relatable, right? You're still searching for truth. You still have to know what questions to ask. You still have to know what the boundaries are and those kinds of things. So as you started looking into this, you're also very responsible in what you're reporting and what you're writing. How are you sorting out rumors from truth? Like, how many sources would you go back to and say, okay, we can finally write this or we can finally say this?
I think we tried to employ just the journalistic principles of having multiple sources. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially if you're dealing with something that's not verified in legal documents or it's not verified in some kind of proof, tangible proof, you want to have multiple sources. So I think there were certain times where it was like, well, we have this from one source and it's so interesting, but we cannot use it because we just don't have it from anyone else and it could just be wrong. So it kind of, I understand why people kind of just run with it, you know, like on social media, whenever, but we just didn't feel we could afford to do that. There'd be other instances where we'd literally drive up there and see for ourselves. So we got a tip, hey, they're searching the Wabash River for evidence. And we drove up there. And I remember it was kind of surreal. We were the only ones up there. We were the only ones in the media who knew about it at that point. And we're looking down. And then the state police dive team is like looking up at us like, wow. Oh, God, you know, and we, you know, and from there, it was a matter of kind of getting more sources to be like, this is what this is. Right. And confirming it. So there would be times like that where you're sort of what you're seeing before you, confirming it with people who are in the know and going from there.
So we had the video, which is Bridge Guy. You can really only make out the words down the hill. And so many, you mentioned the conspiracies. I mean, some of the things people came up with for this case were absolutely unbelievable. I'm all in for exploring every option, but there are some of these options. I was like, what are we doing? So I'm sure you kind of battled that. And like you said, the very vocal minority of people saying those things. But then Richard Allen's arrested. And did you all have a heads up that was coming? Were you as shocked as the rest of us just kind of observing from afar? Did you have a lead on it?
We had not heard the name Richard Allen until after he was arrested.
Okay.
We did hear from a source a couple of days prior to the public announcement of the arrest that an arrest had been made. And we were actually able to confirm before it was publicly announced that there was an arrest. Mm-hmm. But we were asked not to report it, and we honored that request. And it was very, very strange to be walking around with this knowledge that there was this major break in the case and not be able to tell people about it.
Yeah, kudos to you guys for that. I think there's not only temptation to, I mean, we're all out there trying to get people to notice us, right, as podcasters, and that would have gotten you a lot of ears and eyes, but it would have broken the trust. So kudos to you guys for doing things the right way, being some of the good ones out there. So the arrest happens and you guys were in the courtroom a lot. What was that experience like? What was the feel of the town? Like, was everybody kind of, yes, we think this is the guy? Were people hesitant to get their hopes up? What was the vibe in Delphi?
Yeah, I always liken Delphi to a town under siege. So they're kind of preparing for the invasion of the enemy soldiers from outside to pour in. And you'd actually see signs on some of the businesses like no media. And I think that gives you a sense. Right. And it's not because people in Delphi are mean or unfriendly or don't want to welcome people. I think it was just exhaustion and just like, we can't deal with this and we don't want you coming in here and asking us, well, what do you think, for like the millionth time? So I think, you know, it's interesting now that everything's over. I do see a lot of people being like, well, my friends from Delphi and they all think this guy is innocent. And it's like, okay, it's sort of like middle schoolers who everyone has a boyfriend in the school, you know, across the state. Yep. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you got a girlfriend in Canada. I know what that means.
Exactly.
Yeah, you met her at camp this summer. Sure. Okay.
Very real, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. So
I think, you know, when we talk to people, I think in the beginning before trial, there was a lot of open-mindedness, actually. People were like, let's see. What like, I don't know the evidence yet. I'm going to see what I think. Nowadays, I think a lot of the people we talk to, you know, have their opinion about, you know, they feel like this case has been solved and that's it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there might be others who disagree, but I think that's any small town, right, where there's a lot of kind of stuff in between, or maybe you have like a relative who ran afoul of law enforcement and there's some resentment there. So, I mean, opinions can vary, but
And I think another thing that's important to remember is, of course, when the police make an arrest, they, with the prosecutor, prepare a document called a PCA, which is a probable cause affidavit. Mm-hmm. And that's basically explaining to the judge and to the public, here's the evidence. Here's why we thought we needed to arrest this person. And when Richard Allen was arrested, that document in his case was sealed. People weren't allowed to see it. And then when they were allowed to see it, I think they were expecting some really dramatic evidence, DNA or something really shocking. And they didn't get it in that document. And frankly, the document was a little hard to understand. And so a lot of people who read that document were underwhelmed. And because of that,
Anya just raised her hand for those of you.
Yeah, we were in that camp. We were underwhelmed. We were like, we don't really get this. We're not seeing the vision here.
And so because of that, I think a lot of people early on had doubts, which is understandable. In no case should we just automatically assume, oh, the police arrested this man, he must be guilty.
Right.
That's not fair, because the police, like all of us, are human beings and they make mistakes. So I think it was completely fair and reasonable for people to have questions and even doubts.
Of course. At what point did you decide to start writing a book? Was that originally part of the plan eventually? Was there a point you're like, all right, I think we're going to do this? What was that decision like?
I don't know if you've run into this, Jamie, but I always feel like all of us podcasters, like, we either started out wanting to write books or like wanting to do documentaries or some combination thereof, right? We're all and it's about telling stories, right? And it's about conveying that to the audience. So, you know, podcasting definitely does that. But I think Kevin and I, our first love in crime nonfiction were books. And as you could probably see behind us,
so many books.
I'm not that smart. This is all Kevin's.
Sure.
He's a very literate man. But I think we both, you know, just loved some of those classic true crime or crime nonfiction books. And we always wanted to do that. And not every case is going to really make for a good book, just like not every case is going to make for a good extended podcast. Sure. It just sort of depends. And with Delphi, we saw early on that there was so much misinformation going on and frankly, disinformation going on out there, that having a book to sort of clear the air and say, here's what happened. Here's the entire story from beginning to end, where it's not serialized. You're not just kind of jumping into our podcast in the middle of trial and being like, what is going on?
Yeah.
It's just telling the story. And I think that was where, I think, you know, before the trial, we signed a book deal and, you know, we're going to write about this, whatever the outcome is, you know, whatever happens.
It's just such a complicated case, and people would ask us questions about it and we'd say, well, go listen to 100 episodes of a podcast. And that's not really realistic. And it's also confusing, frankly, because we would get pieces of the story maybe out of chronological order. It's like watching a movie and it's cut up and you're just watching it, the scenes, in a random order. Mm-hmm. So just the process of rearranging things so it was chronological, so people could see everything that was happening in a particular part of time. We thought that would really help people understand the facts.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And it is, I mean, just being a podcaster, if somebody asked me a question, I'd be like, it was episode 412, and it's about 2/3 of the way through the episode. You're going to have to fast forward. Like, that's just silly. But you can say, look at chapter 12, page 98, whatever that may be, which is awesome. It's a great way to tell a story. And as you're telling this story, as you guys are writing, I'm very curious about your writing process, but we don't have to go into that here. I'll ask that later. How did you tell the story in such a way that it sets your writing apart from other people covering the story, or how do you feel like you put yourselves into it?
It's interesting. One way I think we kind of put ourselves into it was by taking ourselves out of it.
Love that.
Like, a big part of crime nonfiction these days is sort of almost a hybrid crime nonfiction memoir, where you have someone telling their personal story alongside the case story. Mm-hmm. And that can work really well when it's well done. Like, I mean, I'll Be Gone in the Dark is kind of a classic of the genre, and it gets into the experiences of Michelle McNamara, right? But we didn't feel like we would add anything by being like, well, here's how we were doing
it. Right,
this.
Right.
Like, you know, I felt like we shouldn't be characters. We should be observing the people who are truly at the heart of this case. And that's the families. That's the prosecutors. That's the investigators. That's the defense attorneys. And that's the judge and the wider Delphi community. And we felt that that would be better. And that's more of an old fashioned style of crime nonfiction, but it was one that we felt passionate about doing. So that was sort of, we were very emphatic about, we don't want to be in this. We're not main characters. Sometimes people ask us, hey, if there was a Delphi movie, who would play you? And I'd be like, two weird looking people with glasses who are extras in the background. You see in one scene, you're like, I think that's Kevin and Anya.
It's supposed to be them. Would,
Like, it's a little cameo. Because we're just covering it as reporters, and we just don't have that kind of personal. And unfortunately, things happen in the case where we ended up having to put ourselves in a couple parts of the book where, okay, we're actually unfortunately becoming part of the story. And so we got to explain that here. But we strive to just do that as little as possible.
Yes.
Yeah. And we tried to kind of imbue it with a humanity and an understanding of, like, this is a horrible tragedy and all these people are human beings. And what was it truly like for them to be at the heart of this hurricane? You know, they're in the eye of the storm, and, you know, what's it like dealing with that for years?
Right. It sounds like you're trying to be really objective, which is how we all should be. Right. And what was that? I don't know. People are loud, especially with social media. Everybody has a strong, loud opinion. So how did you go about building the trust with your objectivity? So you're trying to say, we are here for the truth. We're not here to advocate for this or advocate for that. We want justice for these families and these in this town, in such a way that you were able to talk to both sides with the prosecution and defense. That was a very long question to say, how'd you stay objective?
Well, it's a good question. And I'm sure some of our critics would say we didn't, right? There was a certain point where some of the behavior on the defense side became so wild and abnormal that we felt like we would be lying to our audience by trying to whitewash it or pretend like it was normal, or say, oh, yeah, you know, the prosecution filed a motion and the defense is, you know, juggling and doing cartwheels. But that's all very normal. You don't, like, that's at some point, it's not even objectivity. It's just inaccuracy.
Sure.
So the thing that we strive to do, and unfortunately, because we can't force people to talk to us, you know, there's a limit to what we can do here. But what we try to do is go to everyone involved and say, listen, we just want to talk to you and understand where you're coming from, what this was like for you, the choices you made. And the goal is to basically humanize everybody in this situation and get a sense of, you know, it's easy for everyone to sit outside of a situation and criticize it, but perhaps there's a good reason that you did this and that you can convey to us. And at the end of the day, we found the prosecution team and the police incredibly transparent. And I think the defense was upset that we were critical of them at times during the trial. And despite their repeated assurances that they would talk to us for the book, they ended up not responding to us. Okay. And in fact, one of the defense attorneys kind of did a YouTube tour and said, he said he wanted to go talk to outlets that would baby him.
Okay.
So
he's wanting the softballs lobbed up, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, it's a pity because I think he probably thought we were going to sit down and grill him or, you know, say, okay, like you're terrible because we think you did a bad job. Cause I mean, we genuinely think they did a bad job,
yeah.
But at the same time, I don't really care so much about that. I care about the human nature and kind of really conveying who these people are and, you know, why perhaps even if we can disagree with things they did, maybe there's a reason or maybe there was kind of a spark there that we can all understand.
And let me give a quick example. Anya was talking about the defense doing some unusual things. I'll give you an example of one of their filings. During one of the pretrial hearings, at one point, Nick McClelland, who's the prosecutor, said, I need to go to the bathroom. Can we have a break? And the judge says, oh, how much time do you need? And he says, well, the bathroom is just down the hall. And she says, no, ding dong. That's not what I meant. How much time do you need for more questions or what have you? So the defense took that bit of the transcript out and they had a filing where they said the judge never called us ding dongs. That means she doesn't like us as much as she likes him. And that's not fair.
Yes.
And this was in a court filing. And it's funny on some level, but on another level, it's upsetting because they were representing a man whose life was on the line. And I believe Richard Allen was guilty of these crimes. But if I was someone who cared about Richard Allen and wanted to protect his interests, I would be concerned that the attorneys were not focusing on his interests and they were allowing themselves to get distracted by trivia like ding dong.
I'm just gonna say this is a filing where, and just I mean, I'll leave it up to your audience to determine whether this question or this would ever get filed with a male judge, but this is a female judge. This is Judge Frances Gull, and they're basically telling her that she needs to smile more at them. Like, it's not subtle at all. It was the most bizarre and clownish thing, and it's like, at some point, we're not going to pretend, just as if we certainly wouldn't pretend if police or prosecution were right. Doing things like that. I mean, I think you have to some point be like, this is ridiculous. I mean, we were very much hoping for everyone behaving really professionally because that's what you like to see from the system. But it's not what happened in this case, unfortunately.
Yeah. Objectivity doesn't mean just staying away from what's happening. Right. So I completely agree with you. And with some of those things in my mind, it was just desperation of what are we gonna do here? And do you agree with that was some of their tactic, or do you think there was something else there?
I think there were unearned arrogance and some unearned egos going into this, and sort of a moral certainty. Sometimes when you feel like I'm right, I'm good, my opposition is evil and wrong, I can do whatever, then you're going to start doing some pretty extreme things instead of perhaps thinking about it more. And I think there's also a social media element to this, unfortunately, that's like, this is a situation where a certain segment of the online population who's interested in Delphi started treating these defense attorneys like they were rock stars. They're like making little memes of the defense daddies and, oh, how handsome, and aren't they so cute, and we love them. And I tend to think some of the posturing they did was for that audience,
right?
And that's not, you know, you shouldn't be playing to the crowd, you should be playing to the judge if you're an attorney. And so I think seeing that was pretty, I think the defense team was captured to a certain extent by online conspiracy theorists, not the opposite way around. I think they had an echo chamber where they were putting out this stuff and being applauded as the second coming of Clarence Darrow. And I think it ended up blowing up in their faces.
And I think you're right. I think desperation is a good way to put it, because these attorneys had a very poor hand to play. Their client, Richard Allen, says, I was there. I was in the vicinity at the time the murders happened. There are witnesses who saw a person dressed as Richard Allen said he was dressed that day. They saw him walking to the vicinity of the crime scene. Another witness saw a man dressed as Richard Allen said he was dressed that day, walking away from the crime scene. A bullet linked to his gun is found at the murder site. Richard Allen himself confesses or makes incriminating statements about the crime 61 times. It's very hard to come up with a defense to all of that.
It is. Was there a point in time that you recall thinking, okay, that's it? Like, I officially think the threshold of burden of proof has been met.
Yes. So we had an intentional discussion behind the scenes early on before either of us really had any strong opinion either way. But we said, we're not going to declare for guilt or innocence prior to an outcome of a trial. Mm-hmm. And we held to that. I think people probably did see a shift in how we were talking about it at some point, though. And as time went on, I think we both were thinking this is a stronger and stronger case against this man. But we still held out to trial because we thought, hey, the defense is doing very poorly and they seem to be desperate. But at the same time, perhaps there's something at trial that will change our minds and we need to leave room for that. So during trial, I remember this very distinctly, and this is an emotional thing more so than a logical thing. So it's not evidence, and I'm not encouraging anyone to, you know, necessarily follow suit. But I have listened to the Bridge Guy audio so many times, probably like hundreds of times over the years. You're just always listening and just hoping like maybe you'll hear some guy talking and maybe it'll click.
Right.
And, you know, they played Richard Allen's audio of him talking to his wife on the prison phone in, you know, a number of occasions. And when I first heard him, you know, it says, this is a call from, and then he's like, Ricky. When I heard that, I was like,
yeah,
that's him. That's his voice. I'm sorry. Like, it's not evidence in the sense that there's not enough words to do any sort of comparison. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I question the scientific nature of any such comparisons, even if you do have more words.
Agreed.
But that's him.
Yeah.
That's him.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally understand all of that. And so he was found guilty and he was sentenced. What did the town, you said everybody was pretty open-minded early. How did they react to the outcome?
Our experience is most of the people in the town seem to accept his guilt, because once you do really understand the evidence against him, it's really inescapable.
Yeah. I remember I was covering on social media and I tried to stay middle of the road as long as I could. I think it was, and I don't remember all the details, but it was a white van and somebody saw him at like the only time it could have happened. And I went online and I was like, okay, I think I've crossed that burden of proof boundary. And people were still going nuts. They were like, no, you've bought into it. It's awful. So that's still happening. Have you all gotten any pushback from those people about the book since it's come out? I'm sure you did during your reporting, but.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've gotten docs. We've gotten threats. We've gotten people posting pictures of our house. I mean, like,
I'm so it's sorry.
It's these people are just unwell. I think that's the way to describe it. You inevitably look at them and then they're having some personal crisis. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, OK, so you're channeling your anger into this case that you've made into your hobby. Cool. That seems really healthy. I'd say, like, you know, there's always like people, you know, we'll do book signings and people might say, hey, I'm not really convinced about guilt. And we say, we're not here to convince you. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you can understand the decision the jury made if you read the book. Mm-hmm. You don't have to agree with it, but you can understand it. And that's fine. You know, people don't have to agree with us. And I think there's people who can respectfully disagree with each other still. It's just that's not who you run into when you're on social media, right? We have gotten pushback. Honestly, I, for my own mental health, just don't really look at it anymore, because it's like, when you're looking at people, if you were talking to someone you respect and they say, hey, I think you went too far with this, or hey, I think you could do better, then that's feedback you want. And that's constructive criticism that you certainly want. But these people I don't respect, and they're not important. They don't matter. So they've basically just formed a bizarre fandom around a weird middle-aged man who killed two kids. And I don't know how you can help people in that situation or how you get deprogrammed from that. But I mean, if they want to waste their time on it, that's fine. But we, you know, there's always talk of like, oh, we're going to come and, you know, get them, or like, we're going to, you know, one guy, I remember he said he was going to punch me in the face at a book signing. Yeah. It was like, okay, you know, you don't want to fight Kevin, so you're going to fight me. Okay, that's fine. Like, I get you do you,
I'm,
sir.
I'm pretty intimidating.
Kevin's pretty intimidating, but then I'm not going to be able to handle it. But I don't
have
know.
Have you been concerned at any point about your safety to have to take some precautions?
Yeah, I'd say so. At one point, a picture of a home where a special needs relative of ours lives was posted online with FAFO.
Yeah.
And that was concerning. And there are sure. other incidents like that, that there have been a lot of threats to a bizarre extent. Mm-hmm. I can imagine like seeing something on a podcast or in a program that I don't like. I can't imagine getting so upset and worked up about it that I would write to the person and threaten their lives or try to make them fearful. I just don't understand that way of thinking. And it is frustrating because, as Anya indicated, a lot of these people seem to have some sadness going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. I would say when you look at some of these people's writings, a lot of them do have intelligence and they have something to offer. And I wish they would find more meaningful pursuits and make a difference in their communities.
I'm going to say this, though, like as time has gone on, in the beginning, you're like, oh, my gosh, someone's going to come, you know, do something. Mm-hmm. And over time, you stop, you know, you just are like,
sure,
these are internet keyboard warriors. Mm-hmm. And we're not the only ones who get this. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who worked on the case sure. do get harassed. They do get stalked. And that same goes for the victims' families. They get a lot of harassment and a lot of stalking and creepy comments and just horrible stuff. So I'm kind of like, my attitude is like, if we draw fire away from that to a certain extent, then whatever, that's good, because these people already lost these kids. Like, they shouldn't have to be dealing with this on top of everything else. So if they want to like mess with us, we chose to be here. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't. So fine.
Love that attitude. I think that's perfect. And I'm kudos to you again for learning to not read the comments. I encourage people out there, don't read the comments ever, ever, ever. So the book's out. Is this over? Do you feel like there's going to be any room for appeal with the defense doing some outlandish things? Is there any ineffective counsel? Like, do you see any of that happening?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, certainly there will be an appeal, and that should be coming up in the coming months. I mean, the appeals team may ask for, it seems like is asking for more time to mm-hmm. do that. But they, you know, they're going to do that, and they're probably going to do their best. There's going to be probably a number of issues they raise. One big thing will be the judge did not allow the defense to go with their Odinist theory of a cult did it in the woods because there wasn't enough of a nexus there. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they will complain endlessly about that. And, you know, but I think ineffective counsel, you know, that's an interesting thing, because we've certainly been very critical of the trial defense team and their performances. But I think it's a pretty high bar to cross as far as ineffective. And that tends to be more of like people aren't doing things or they're like on drugs. And I certainly don't see any evidence that any of the defense team was necessarily messing up to that extent. It was more that they were primping and preening for the media too much and perhaps not thinking strategy through.
And another complicating factor there is at one point Judge Gull threw the defense attorneys off the case mm-hmm. and basically said, I don't have confidence in you. And Richard Allen fought all the way to the Supreme Court to get them put back on the case. And it's as if, you know, if I'm warned, Kevin, if you eat a lot of candy and junk food, you're going to get really fat. And then I eat a lot of candy and junk food. Am I really able to say, oh, I'm upset, I have to sue somebody? I mean, I knew what I was mm-hmm. doing. And Richard Allen, using these attorneys after that warning, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's essentially waiving any complaining about them at all, because you fought so hard to keep them. Yeah, you bring these things up and I'm like, oh, I forgot about that crazy piece or that crazy piece. Like, because it was just constant at some point. And I felt like You know, I mean, let's just get on with it. And like they were stalling, whatever. All that to say, you guys have done a really good job laying this out. You've written in a book. You're doing signings. So is there a schedule of signings people could find if they want to come see you? And where can they find it online or in bookstores?
Absolutely. So the book is available for sale in the United States, at least on Amazon. There is a ebook. There is the hard copy. I always encourage people, hey, if you can go to your local bookstores and get your order through them, that's a great way to support local businesses. And we all love our local bookstores.
Also an audiobook.
Which Kevin actually narrated.
Okay. So. I was going to ask if you did an audiobook when you all did it. That's awesome.
Yeah,
love that.
He did a really good job and I'm really proud of him. And he sounded really great, but he doesn't want me to say that because he gets nervous, but he did.
No,
and as for events, you know, we're always open to different things. So if people want to pitch us, we're at murdersheet@gmail.com, but people can find, I believe it's, let me actually get this link up here because I don't want to get it wrong, but there's a place where people can see, it's like, our website is murdersheetpodcast.com/events. And that just all.
Okay,
we're
wonderful.
Mostly sticking to Indiana at this point, but we're open to possibly doing a weird kind of cobbled together book tour where it's just Kevin and I driving around randomly. So, you know, that may happen, may not. We're not really sure at this point, but we'll see.
Yeah, nope. That's great. And we'll put those links in the show notes, certainly. And I hope people come out and meet you all. If nothing else, read this book. I mean, you think you know everything about the case, but you guys were there. You were in the courtroom, and there's really no substitute for that. So I think if people are interested, especially if they still have questions, go and find the truth. That's what we're here for, right? But I think people are going to ask, what's next? What big project are we tackling now? You may hate that question, and I'm sorry if you do, but I had to ask it.
Why'd you do it to us, Jamie?
Had to.
I'm just kidding. That is a good question. We don't know. And we do want to do another deep dive into a case. That could be a book. That could just be coverage on the podcast. Sure. Could be two different things or all the same case.
Yeah, we're still doing the podcast 3 times a week.
Yeah, we're doing the podcast. We do a lot of non kind of deep dives where it's like maybe we're going to bring on an author or we're going to like, you know, kind of cover this case in some depth. It's just not going to be like lasting for years like Delphi did. We want to find a book or a podcast topic where we feel we can add something. In Delphi, because we're here, we were able to go and provide analysis on the ground, and that was great. And I feel like we added something from that. But you know, we never want to do a case that's just like, oh, it's really big, and we're just going to be repeating what everyone else is saying about it. We would want to be like, okay, we're truly adding something here. And so we just have to figure out what the right case for that is.
We have a couple of ideas.
We have some ideas, and it's not a zero sum game, but we just want to be really cautious about what we take on because we don't want to just be like, this is a big case, we'll write a book about it. And it's like, well, maybe someone else is better positioned or has the trust in that community to do a better job than we could. So we don't want to like do something like that.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to your continued work on your podcast for sure. And then we'll be on the lookout for any other big projects. But in the meantime, I'll put all the links in the show notes and encourage everybody to look up your book. So Anya and Kevin, thanks so much for hanging out with me for a little bit.
Jamie, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. This was a delightful interview and we love your show. And I'm sorry again, we missed you at CrimeCon, but it's been a real pleasure and we just honored to be here. So thank you.
We'll see you in Vegas. Thanks, guys. Once again, that was Anya Kane and Kevin Greenlee from the Murder Sheet podcast, breaking down the Delphi case and certainly some more to come from them. Just want to make sure you go check out their book. There are links in the show notes. The book is called Shadow of the Bridge, The Delphi Murders and the Dark Side of the American Heartland. And I can tell you it's the most thorough, genuine reporting on the Delphi case that I've seen. So go buy it now.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.